Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Thanks for joining us today on Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Streaked with light and shadow. Portraits of Former Soviet Jews in Utah. That's the title of a book. It was published about 10 years ago. It's also the title of an event that will be happening on Wednesday evening at 6:30 at the Wagner Jewish Community Center, which is at 2 North Medical Drive in Salt Lake City. The book and the event documents the immigration of Jews from the Soviet Union to Utah. Soviet Jewish immigrants, 477 people in all, arrived in Utah in three waves, and the book includes interviews with 50 of those conducted over a two-year period. Leading the discussion is author of the book, Leslie Kellen, editor and executive director of the Center for Documentary Arts, and he'll be joined by several interviewees from the book. We'll get a glimpse into life in the Soviet Union and former Soviet Union, look at Soviet anti-Semitism, and other interesting facts, the life of some of these immigrants once they've arrived in Utah. And with us are Leslie Kellen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Appreciate you taking the time to be with us. We also have with us Natasha Rappaport. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, hello.
And Alex Krabsov. Thanks.
Thank you.
And I assume that Ms. Rappaport and Mr. Krabsov, you'll be involved in the event on Wednesday evening.
Yes, yeah, that's
right.
Very, very good. Let me start with you, Mr. Kellen. I wonder, I believe you have a copy of the book with you.
I do. I have to correct you, though. Our organization's name is Center for Documentary Expression and Art.
Center for Documentary Expression in Art. Okay.
Yeah, we changed it not too long ago, and so I just needed to correct you on that.
Okay. And we'll need to get that corrected on the King's English book site, bookshop site. I'm quoting directly from them. Okay, so the Center for Documentary Expression in Arts. And by the way, I need to credit King's English Bookshop. I believe they're one of the sponsors of this event, or at least they're publicizing it.
Mm-hmm. They are.
So, Mr. Kellen, I wonder if you could read for us just the dedication page, not the dedication, but the first page, the quote from Zvi Gittleman. This explains the why you use this particular title and sort of sets this up.
Sure. Beginning in 1825, the Tsars began to deal vigorously with what they saw as their Jewish problem, setting off the cycle of repression and relaxation that was to create and recreate enormous Jewish ambivalence toward their homeland. It is in the last 100 years especially, though, that Jews and the people among whom they have lived have been locked into a tempestuous, intense relationship from which none of the parties has been able to free itself completely, nor in many cases resolve their differences. On the other hand, that relationship has produced great achievements and advances for both Jews and others. Thus, the modern history of Jews in Russia and the Soviet Union is streaked with light and shadow. It is a story still unfolding.
So that explains the title, Streaked with Light and Shadow. You also write in your preface to the book that for immigrants from the Soviet Union or former Soviet Union to Utah or any place, that's two journeys in one. I wonder if you could expand on that.
Yeah, well, I was saying that essentially that there's a physical journey to leave their country of origin and with all the complications of that departure. And then there's the actual journey to become members of the society that they joined. And that's no longer a physical journey. That's a psychological, imaginative journey in which they have to both come to terms with the experiences of the place they left behind, particularly if those experiences were destructive, were harmful to them, and find some way to gather it psychologically into themselves and to make sense of it to the people that they are not coming into contact with.
You illustrate this effectively by using extensive passage from a Joseph Brodsky book. You tell us how you came to include that.
Well, in the process of doing putting the book together, one of the things we were trying to do is to essentially create a publication that focused on the assets of the immigrant and refugee community, not so much only their process of acculturation into our community, but essentially who they were and what they came with. And we were looking for a way to preface this, to give a sense of this of the Soviet society that they had left behind. And Joseph Rosky's essay provided essentially a couple of things to us. One is that we had the opportunity, for quite fortunately, to bring in the work of a major poet and writer, and at the same time, because he is so evocative in terms of talking about the world that he left behind, to use this as a kind of a framework or a backdrop for all of the interviewees. So it really accomplished those two feats for us.
And his book, for people who are not familiar, In a Room and a Half, and you have extensive passages from this. Joseph Brodsky, of course, Nobel laureate, former poet laureate of the United States, he was not able to reconnect with his parents, right? Once he came, they tried, but he was not able to, and so it's very poignant. He only can go back in memory once he goes back.
That's correct, yeah. He was exiled basically from the Soviet Union, and essentially told that if he didn't go into exile, that he would be punished there, possibly imprisoned there, perhaps worse. And so once he left, he knew he wasn't going to be returning. But his parents were never given the opportunity to visit him, and so this long piece that he wrote was in memory of them, was a way to re-embrace the connection that he had with them. Obviously, he was very close with them. And it was a way for us to say something about the world that had been left behind by all of the people that we were interviewing.
Let me ask you about the first wave of emigration. Then we'll get to, I believe, Natasha Rappaport is included in the book in the second wave, and Alex Kravtsov in the third wave. We'll get their stories as told by them. Tell us a little bit about the first wave and specifically to Utah.
Well, essentially the first wave came under Brezhnev, and it was probably the most difficult time to leave the Soviet Union, because people were essentially coming up against a still a very repressive Soviet system. During the second period, when Gorbachev was there, it really became somewhat easier. So essentially, in the first wave, we're dealing with people who are very timidly, who of course want to leave, but who are very timid about announcing their departure because they don't quite know how the system will respond to them. And there are a variety of ways the system can respond. It can alienate them. It can humiliate them. It can postpone their departure. It can make it impossible for them to depart. So essentially, these were people who wanted to leave but who were facing a series of potential horrors in the prospect of doing so. And of course, they would be leaving as refugees once they got out of the country and would be interviewed by the American consulate either in Vienna or Italy once they got out. And then they would tell their stories, and then the American consulate would permit them to come into the U.S. as refugees. Of course, many of them were also going to Israel. As you probably noted from the preface, the vast majority of people that were able to leave the Soviet Union went to Israel. And about a third of about 1.5 million, maybe a 1.75 million, came to the United States.
And then many of these would have at least first stopped in a large city, maybe on the eastern coast, and then for jobs. Is that why they came to Utah?
Yeah. Many of them actually sort of came to New York. Others went to the West Coast. I was just in New York recently and actually met a rabbi who had been involved in the very early effort by Jews in the United States to put pressure on the former Soviet Union to begin the processes of allowing Jews to leave from there. And that process began in the 60s, 62 to 65, somewhere in there. And there were demonstrations before the UN, there were demonstrations before the Soviet consulate, there were marches. But essentially, people tried to find jobs in big cities, and when other job opportunities became available inland, then they went, you know, into other places. And, of course, also the Jewish Family Services probably should be mentioned here, because they also made it possible for some relocation efforts to take place, both for people coming from other communities as well as people coming here directly, which were in the minority.
If you just joined us, we are talking about a book and an event. The book is Streaked with Light and Shadow, Portraits of Former Soviet Jews in Utah. It documents the immigration of Jews from the Soviet Union to Utah. They came in three waves, and some 477 people in all arrived in Utah. Includes interviews with 50 of them, conducted over a two-year period. The author is Leslie Kellen, editor and executive director of the Center of Documentary Expression in the Arts. Did I get it right, Mr. Kellen?
Yep. That's closer.
Okay. He'll lead the discussion tonight. As I mentioned, this is an event based on the book, 6:30 in the evening on Wednesday at the Wagner Jewish Community Center in Salt Lake City. And all of our guests on the program today will be included at that event. And I assume, Mr. Kellen, that's, what, free and open to the public?
That's free and open to the public, yes.
Very good. Let's bring in Natasha Rappaport. Thanks for joining us on the program. I was very interested to read your interview, an extensive interview with Leslie Kellen in this book. I wonder if you could start. I was struck by this. It's a total paradigm shift for me that growing up in the Soviet Union, you as a child felt very lucky and, in fact, thought that American children were unlucky to have been born in America.
I was completely brainwashed as a child. You know, I was a normal Soviet child attending Soviet school, listening to all these lies that were given to us and believing them. And it took pretty hard hammer to hit me, to open my eyes, you know, and it happened during one night in 1953 when my father was arrested. And my father was a very prominent pathologist, actually number one pathologist in the country. And he was involved, of course, in the cream of Soviet Medical Society. And many of them, my father and his friends and colleagues, were consulting in the Kremlin Hospital. And the last year of the Stalin's life in 1952, he became completely paranoid, and he accused doctors in the Kremlin Hospital in killing their patients instead of treating them, and spying for America, for Israel, for England, for a number of countries, actually. I think my father was accused of being a spy for American Israel, mainly. They were accused in killing their patients. They were called murderous doctors, scum on earth. Most of them were Jewish. My father, as a pathologist, it would be strange to accuse him in killing his patients, but he was accused in concealing the crimes of the others, of his colleagues. Mm. And all these people were close friends of the family, most of people involved in this so-called doctor's plot or murderous doctor's group. And they were in our houses as personal guests, and they were my personal doctors, too. You know, they went through my whole life as a child. And I couldn't believe what I read and heard over the radio. And these events unleashed a very vigorous anti-Semitic propaganda. Because most of the accused doctors were Jewish. people in the street, you know, they believed this nonsense. And they were afraid to go to Jewish doctors, to go to clinics. They were afraid to, and refused to be treated by Jewish doctors. There were rumors that medicines and pharmacies were poisoned by Jews, and people were afraid to buy medicines and to be treated or get their kids treated. So it was a horrible panic
in the country. And your father was arrested, right? Sent to prison.
Yeah, my father was arrested, and he was involved in this major group of so-called murderous doctors. Yeah, I mean, he was accused of being a member of this murderous group. And they actually had to be executed. A very spectacular execution was planned for them at the Red Square. And it was several days that separated them from this execution. But then the miracle happened. Stalin died.
Mm.
And Stalin died kind of several days before the planned execution, which was immediately stopped. Mm. And all doctors were released from prison a month later. Mm. Stalin died March 5th. All doctors were released April 4th. Mm. So a month later.
And you write, or you're interviewed in the book as saying that parents had to be careful with their children. Your parents were careful not to open your eyes, so to speak, to let you live in sort of this dream world as regards the Soviet Union. And you had to be careful with your children as well. You had to have kind of a mask on, right? Otherwise, you could be in trouble.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, ever since this event of the doctor's plot, I was with the dissidents. It opened my eyes once and forever. I was involved in a very wonderful circle of friends, and many of them went, because they were dissidents, they went to prisons and concentration camps in the Soviet Union. I was lucky not to be caught on the so-called criminal behavior, what was considered to be criminal by Soviet system. So I was not arrested, but we had to be really cautious about what we say and whom we befriend, because otherwise it was very, very easy to end up in prison and camp.
How did you come to emigrate then?
Well, my way to Utah was kind of unusual because I didn't go through a normal immigration system. For 50 years, Soviets never granted me the passport to go abroad. My first trip abroad was when Gorbachev came to power and perestroika started. And it was a conference. I don't remember exactly because two conferences were one after the other. The first one was in Geneva, in Lausanne, in Switzerland, and the other one in Prague. And at one of those two conferences, I met Dr. De Vries, who was a deputy associate dean of the College of Engineering in Utah. And I was one of the key speakers over there, and after my talk, he came by and said very nice words about my work. And he told me, if you ever come to America, please give me a call, because I would like to invite you to give a talk to our faculty at the University of Utah. And he gave me a business card, and it was the very first business card I ever saw in my life. I still keep it. And but when he said, if you ever go to America, please give me a call, at this time it sounds like if you ever fly to Mars, don't forget to call me from there.
Right.
But then it happened because my father wrote a book about the doctor's plot, and I wrote my own account of the same events, and it was published. Both of them were published by the 35th anniversary of the doctor's plot in 1988. And it was like an explosion of the bomb. And all journalists from all over the world were at our door. And it was front page New York Times with the photograph of my father and myself. And it was a big paper in Washington Post as well. So Dr. De Vries read it. I got the invitation from, actually it was from Doubleday, from a person who was a consultant in the Doubleday. We got offers from 7 publishing houses in America to publish my father's book and my story. And I was invited as a personal guest. I came and I had the business card of Dr. De Vries, and I called him. And he immediately invited me to Utah. I gave a presentation. Apparently, they liked me. He asked me if I would like to come, would care to come for a quota as a W.W. Clyde chair. It's a prestigious position for a foreign scientist at the College of Engineering. And, of course, I was very happy to accept this invitation. And this 3 months that I was invited for last now for 21 years. Mm. Because it just happened that I didn't come back to the Soviet Union after I came to Utah for 3 months.
Mm. Very good. We are talking on this part of Access Utah with Natasha Rappaport and also with Leslie Kellen. And we're going to be talking with Alex Kravtsov, hear his story of immigration from the former Soviet Union. We're getting a glimpse into life in the Soviet Union, in the former Soviet Union, anti-Semitism there, and immigration to various areas, and we're focusing on immigration to Utah. The book is Streaked with Light and Shadow, Portraits of Former Soviet Jews in Utah. The author of the book is Leslie Kellen, editor and executive director of the Center for Documentary Expression in the Arts. And there will be an event with the same title, Streaked with Light and Shadow, Portraits of Former Soviet Jews in Utah. That's Wednesday evening at 6:30 at the Wagner Jewish Community Center. Some of these same stories will be told, others as well. Natasha Rappaport and Alex Kravtsov, along with Leslie Kellen, will be there along with others. You're welcome to join this conversation if you would like at 1-800-826-1495. Following a brief break, we'll hear the experience of Alex Kravtsov. It follows the break.
This is Jennifer Pemberton, website manager at Utah Public Radio, inviting you to visit the new upr.org. Our new website features dynamic news stories from all over the state, daily posts for Access Utah, interactive program schedules, and easy online listening. Go now to upr.org, your favorite public radio website for Utah news and UPR programs.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now with new hours, open Monday through Saturday 7 until 3 and Saturday 8 until 3, offering a changing menu of French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits and serving lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about the former Soviet Union, life there, anti-Semitism, and the book is Streaked with Light and Shadow, Portraits of Former Soviet Jews in Utah. Emigration of Jews from the Soviet Union to Utah occurred in 3 waves, and 477 people in all arrived over the years. The book includes interviews with 50 of them, conducted over a two-year period. Author of the book is Leslie Kellen, editor and executive director of the Center for Documentary Expression in the Arts. He'll be moderating that discussion on Wednesday evening at 6:30 at the Wagner Jewish Community Center. Several people interviewed in the book will be at that event. And we've been hearing the story of Natasha Rappaport, who immigrated to Utah. Now we're going to bring in Alex Krabsov. Alex Krabsov, understand that sort of your awakening came and you got interested in the opening that was called Glasnost, and previously banned books, films, essays, documentaries became available. You were interested in that opening, and that became a key moment for you, understand it.
That's right. It wasn't that I just became interested. It was something that... to use Natasha's expression, hit me like a hammer, because it turned upside down everything or a lot of things that I knew about or I thought I knew about the Soviet Union and the kind of system it was, even though I lived by the beginning of Perestroika, mid-80s. I lived long enough in the Soviet Union and I could have understood. But still, I didn't have enough information, I guess, to make this breakthrough to see the system for what it was. And so when Gorbachev came to power in 1985 and so-called perestroika and glasnost gradually began, there was a lot of new information, mostly about the Stalin period of the Soviet Union, which I had no idea about, and that actually changed my views drastically.
What sorts of things did you learn?
Well, the Gulag system, to put it simply, I had no idea about it. It's hard to believe for you, probably, and even for me now, who had access to this information, but in the Soviet Union, it was such a total system of information control that and indoctrination from the early age that even if you got pieces, bits and pieces of it, mostly from people who lived through that period, like my parents' generation, even though they too were even afraid to talk about that, but you would, because of the indoctrination, you simply resisted that information. You couldn't accept it. And so my knowledge was limited, to put it mildly. Mm.
So that's interesting. Because of the indoctrination, you just refuse to not just you, but to refuse to believe certain things, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Because there was, you know, a certain coherent system of views that the Soviet Union or the Soviet propaganda instilled in you from the early one, like from the kindergarten all the way. It was such a politicized system of education. And so it's not even surprising that even now in Russia, when all the information is out and anybody can access it, just recently, Stalin came as the most important figure, I think the first or the second, in a big survey among Russians.
Hmm. I wonder if you could tell, let's backtrack a little bit, tell me that part of the interview where you encountered some anti-Semitism. You graduated, I think, what, first or second in your class?
Yep.
And you were... It looked like all systems were go. You were going to be accepted at a very prestigious organization until they found out you were a Jew.
Yeah, that's right. It's the way the system, the educational and or higher education system and employment worked. First of all, one of the, just to understand, to set up the scene, you didn't have to look for a job. The jobs were assigned to you upon graduation, depending on your academic achievements. And since I was, I don't remember, the first or the second in my class, I was assigned a job at the Belarusian, I lived in Minsk, which was the capital of then Belarus Soviet Republic, which is now a separate country. So I was assigned a job at the Belarusian Academy of Sciences. That was the Soviet elite academic or research system. And apparently they didn't read my papers closely enough. So when I came to the way it was done, you would first be greeted by the chief scientist or the director of that institution, and he greeted me warmly and invited me to join their team, hoping that I would contribute and so on and so forth. And then I went to human resources, and there I had to fill out, you know, the application forms, which was supposed to be a formality. But when I, and in the Soviet Union, there was a special column for your ethnicity called nationality. And depending who you were, and it wasn't something that was, you could put arbitrarily because it was written in your domestic papers, so it was attached to you. And so I put Jew, and their faces just became very long. And from there on, I was kicked around for about a month, and they tried to get rid of me under different pretexts, and they couldn't. And finally, well, as I told Leslie, well, what happened that finally one of those more sympathetic to me guys, he just pulled me into a dark corner and said, well, write a letter asking for an explanation to the top bosses at the academy without saying anything, just telling them, here's my position that I was assigned to, my slot at this institution, and I'm still not, you know, accepted. I don't know why. So that's what I did, and then they had to swallow hard and take me.
Hmm. There came a time, I imagine it comes a time in anyone who decides to immigrate, where you have an inner break with the system as you knew it. I imagine that happened with you. Did you decide to emigrate soon thereafter? Did it take some time?
Well, actually, I guess I was lucky because this inner break came at the time when it was still possible to emigrate from the Soviet Union and got into the United States. And so it was basically an inner struggle, but when I finally came to the decision, I never looked back, and then went through the channels available at the time and came straight to Salt Lake.
Hmm. We've been talking here with Alex Krabstov. Also, we heard the story of Natasha Rappaport. Of course, much else to tell, and you can hear their stories and others of Soviet Jews in Utah at an event on Wednesday evening at 6:30. The event and the book are titled Streaked with Light and Shadow, Portraits of Former Soviet Jews Living in Utah. The author of the book is Leslie Kellen, conducted these interviews along with others. He's editor and executive director of the Center for Documentary Expression in the Arts. Just a couple of minutes left in the conversation here. I want to turn back to Mr. Kellen. I was struck by something you wrote in the preface. I guess this goes to why the book, why this event, why we're looking at these stories. You wrote that the world that formed these people exists now only in memory, so especially important to tell these stories.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But
workshop. There were two other motivations that were involved in this, is that I came to the United States as an immigrant myself in 1959. And one of the things that I saw in my own community is that my parents and the extended family that I lived with were so determined to become Americans that their own stories, their lives, the difficult things that they had lived through in Europe as Jews were essentially sort of put behind them. And so I wanted to make the effort to preserve this moment in the bigger sense, and to allow us to really understand who these people were, what they were coming from, what they were bringing. And I felt they had tremendous assets. And so this was a way to bring that to light.
Very good. The event is 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Wagner Jewish Community Center, which is at 2 North Medical Drive in Salt Lake City. And several people will be telling their experiences. The book is Streaked with Light and Shadow, Portraits of Former Soviet Jews in Utah. I've been talking with Leslie Kellen. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, too.
Natasha Rappaport, thanks for telling your story.
Thank you.
And Alex Krabsov, thanks so much to you.
Thank you.
Coming up following a break in which we'll hear a Steve Eaton commentary, we're going to talk with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Ann Cannon. We'll talk about the lost art of the handwritten note and related topics. That's following the break.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
The basic necessities that one needs for life support these days are far greater than they were for people in days of yore. Recently, I signed up to go to a two-day training workshop across town. I did not have to sleep overnight, but I was surprised how complicated it was to leave the office during the workday. First of all, my work back in the office would keep coming in, so I needed to be able to check my email during every break. I have the latest and greatest iPhone, so I'd be prepared to answer email right there on my phone. I decided, however, it would be wise to throw in my Bluetooth keyboard so that I could type out a message faster if I needed to. I know that my sophisticated phone is set up so that you can just dictate your email right into it, but the robo lady Siri doesn't like me and has practically told me so to my face. "Siri, do you like me?" I asked once when we were alone. "I'd rather not say, Steve," she responded, acting as if she couldn't wait to get off work. I realized, however, that to answer some emails, I might need to draw from other documents in my computer, so I decided to pack my laptop. Then I remembered how hard it can be to boot up a laptop during the break, so I decided to bring along the iPad my son gave me, too. I made sure I brought the Bluetooth keyboard that he bought for it, just in case it's too hard to type on the letters on the iPad screen. Of course, I had to bring the backup power cords for all these devices, so I had to wrap each of them carefully and squeeze them into my backpack. It was like a puzzle, only a puzzle with lots of cords. I really wanted to get all I could from the conference, so I decided to bring a small digital recorder, even though my phone is equipped with several recording applications. I don't yet know exactly which one works best or what Siri might do to them. I knew I had a cassette recorder in the car to back me up if my digital recorder failed me. Then I remembered what a pain it can be to transcribe notes, so I decided I needed to bring my Live Scribe pen. This fancy pen can also record, but to use it properly you need special paper, so I slotted in some of its special notebooks. The advantage of using this pen, which records too, is that instead of transcribing, you merely touch the pen to your notes, and it plays not just the sounds you were hearing when you took the notes, but the sound of your pen frantically scratching on the special paper. It's good to have as a backup in case your digital recorder, cassette recorder, and cell phone fail you. Since I was sort of traveling loose and free that day, I didn't check to be sure my Bluetooth headset was in my backpack, but I was pretty sure it was there, along with my walkie-talkie that I always carry with me, because I'm part of the Neighborhood Disaster Attack Team. In fact, I'm a blockhead with lots of responsibility. I also left my Strong Idea head spa at home because I know it can disturb others who take pills for headaches. It is this large, helmet-like, vibrating thing that does look like something that was stolen off the set of Battlestar Galactica, and there's really no way I could have fit it into my backpack. I just packed in some Excedrin along with my Fix Your Memory drugs and afternoon purple paranoia pill. The last two are made up with all natural ingredients that Mother Nature herself came up with so that people can have safe pills to buy. I forget what the ingredients are, but I know the government doesn't want anyone to know about them. The seminar was one where we talked about a management philosophy that tries to eliminate waste and simplify things for the workers and the customer. They taught us of a lean approach that's designed to make workers more efficient and is aimed at helping people learn how not to waste time investing in things that don't really move them toward their goals. I was glad that I had come prepared but not overdone it. Everything I needed I had squished into a single backpack that is specially designed for people who carry electronic devices with them into the great outdoors. Other people came to the seminar with nothing and had to use the free pen and notebook the seminar people provided, but I knew they were unprepared for the day. I felt pretty good about myself. After that first day, as I left the building, I found myself softly singing the Jungle Book hit, "Look for the Bare Necessities." I tried to mimic the happy swagger of the carefree bear Baloo, but unfortunately my backpack was so heavy I lost my balance and fell into some thorny shrubberies in front of the place. "What can I help you with?" Siri asked from my pocket. "Siri, I'm hurt," I said, wanting at least sympathy. "Steve, I don't understand. Siri, I'm hurt," she said, pretending to be dumb. Then my mood really changed and it started to rain. So I realized I'd not only forgotten to pack a first aid kit, but I'd left my portable poncho at home, along with my electric hand warmers. This is Steve Eaton.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We've reached our last segment for today. I recently read a column, the Salt Lake Tribune, of Ann Cannons. You very likely are familiar with her work if you're a regular reader of Salt Lake Tribune. She's also a writer of fiction for children and young adults, a creative writing teacher, mother of five sons. Her first young adult novel, Cal Cameron by Day, Spider-Man by Night, won the Delacorte Press Prize for Outstanding First Young Adult Novel. She's also author of Charlotte's Rose and Loser's Guide to Life and Love and others. The column, I wanted to talk about this, talked about a New Year's resolution. I think it struck a chord with some people, and that is that Ann Cannon determined to write more handwritten notes. Becoming a lost art, it seems. We welcome in Ann Cannon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Oh, doing well. Doing
good.
Well. Good. You throw out a few other resolutions and say that we all probably feel that resolutions are more for breaking than for keeping.
Yes, I have a lot of experience on that front. So,
I like your resolution to your family members.
Yeah.
Married kids promised to move back to Utah.
They never worked, but there you go.
Yeah. But it struck a chord, and it seems like with the comments section to this column, seems like it struck a chord, handwritten notes. And this was precipitated by some notes that you had received. I wonder if you could tell us about a few of those.
Yeah, I had a really nice experience, actually. I mean, I have to say that for whatever reasons, this holiday season just left me kind of flattened. I just really, I don't know. And in the midst of all of this, I received a note from a coworker, and she just said to me, she's young, she's newly married, and she said, you know, I really don't have any money for gifts, but I wanted to give you this. So she handed me a card, and I thought, you know, this is lovely. It's going to be a Christmas card. I love Christmas cards. But when I opened it up, she had taken time to write a pretty long note, and it was written in hand, and it was she just was very detailed and very specific about some of the things that she liked about me. And I thought, this is just a great gift. And then at the same time, I received a letter from another friend who I didn't get a chance to see over the holidays. And she wrote me this long letter, like the kinds of letters girlfriends and I used to exchange when we were 13 and 14. My best friend was living abroad at that time, and we'd write these long, long, heartfelt letters to each other. And the letter reminded me of that. And I just thought, what a great treasure to have these bits of these people with their handwriting, which is very identifiable as their own handwriting.
And it occurs to me, probably has occurred to you, if you and your girlfriends have been writing those letters in a different era, today's era, that might have been via email or social media.
Right.
What do you think would have been lost?
Well, first of all, I need to make it clear. I'm a big fan of email. I get to stay in touch with a lot of people that way, and also it's easier to do some work that way. But I think what gets lost with email is the first of all, just the visual part of a person's self. You know, that handwriting is so expressive of that individual in the comment. I mean, in the column, I just say, like, I can look at a piece of paper and know immediately who it came from by the handwriting. And that's kind of a nice thing. The other thing is I think there's something about when you write a handwritten letter, it is a deal. And so you have to sort of settle down into it. And I think that they're just almost newsier than maybe an email might be. I could be wrong about that. But I don't think that. And then the other thing, too, is that email evaporates. Texts evaporate. Usually, handwritten letters kind of stick around as a journal a little bit more, I think.
Let me read one of the comments in the comment section attached to your column.
Okay.
I don't know if you've read these. This is from Cheyenne Gran. She says, I assume it's her, great column. I received a couple of lengthy handwritten letters in Christmas cards this year, and it meant a lot that they would take the time.
Right.
Continue on the next page. During such a busy time to write, the messages of love and appreciation were treasured gifts. I love the computer-generated newsletters, too, but the handwritten personalized letters were very special. I'm going to do it more this year, too. And then they write, it's too easy to pick up the phone and send a Facebook message, mm-hmm. email, and text. So something about maybe the fact that it's a little harder to do brings
right.
out something better in us?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that she actually hits, if she does hit on the idea there that there is a certain amount of effort that's involved with it. And sometimes think of that effort as being a gift in and of itself. You mean enough to that person that they'll take the time to do this.
And you write very movingly about your friend Marilyn. I wonder if you could share that.
Well, I had this great friend. She was actually closer to my mother's age, but she was just this huge, larger-than-life presence. I mean, she just, when she walked into a room, she just filled up a room, and she dressed flamboyantly, and she loved the movies, and she was a collector of all kinds of things, and she just loved a good time. And I kind of wandered into her sphere, and she just immediately just embraced me, like she did with a lot of people. But she was very, very good about giving me little presents with little notes attached. And, you know, of course, I always appreciated those then, but she died of colon cancer a while ago, and I was privileged to speak at her funeral. But I realized that one of the things that I have of hers is I have her actual handwriting. And that, to me, seems more a part of her than the gifts that she gave me, and I still have those as well. But I just cherish those pieces of herself so much now that I don't see her, and now I don't have her anymore.
So it is just something, a part of that person, in a way that an email, printed out email, couldn't do, I suppose.
I think so. I mean, I think so. And as I say, I mean, I do love email, but those letters just brought to mind again to me how this is something that we're kind of losing, and I want to at least keep a part of that alive for me and for, you know, the people in my life.
Mm. Also wondering maybe how this would connect us or less so with our ancestors. Say, you know, you print out an email from great-grandpa versus something that he handwrote. There's mm-hmm. a difference there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would definitely be easier to read what the email.
Yeah, I suppose there'd be an advantage.
What the email said. So from that standpoint, the more uniform look of an email or typewritten anything is great that way. But again, it to me at least, it speaks to an individual's quirks, personality, tastes, skills even, to see what their handwriting looked like. So having both would be nice, I think.
Yeah, I suppose having both would be nice. I guess some people would say, boy, it's a great resolution. Probably be like a lot of resolutions. And if you're going to hear from me, you're probably want an email because I'm going to do that versus handwritten note, which I'll intend to do, but I won't do.
Yeah. It's true. And, you know, I have to confess that I went out and bought some boxes of Pretty Little Stationery, everything like that, and those boxes are still sitting on my desk. So it is a harder resolution to keep in some ways than I think. But I still have hopes for myself. I still plan on doing it. But I also think that if you have the impulse to get in touch with somebody, that don't let this be a daunting thing. Like, if it's just going to, you're not going to get that handwritten note done, then by all means, email, call, whatever. I mean, the point is connection. Mm-hmm. But I do like this idea of just of the personal touch of handwriting. Mm.
Have you heard from people?
I have actually. Verbally mostly, but mm-hmm. people have told me that they read the article, that they liked it, that they agreed, that they would like to do it themselves. So, you know, we'll see.
And I guess what you would like to see is a lot of handwritten notes.
Guys,
a lot of handwritten
notes.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, it struck a chord with me and others reading the Tribune and others that I'm sure you have heard from. So maybe this will start something. We'll see more handwritten notes in addition to the emails and such. I noticed on another column, the 50 things you learned or relearned in 2011, something I share with you as well. You'd still rather read a book than a Kindle.
I know.
Is that just a generational thing? Do you think
I think it probably is. Although I have to say that my parents, who were in their late 70s and early 80s, are much more techno-savvy than I am. I mean, they've got iPads. They're doing the whole electronic thing. They really like it. But I do think that people of a certain generation especially are just going to always love the experience of a handheld book. And I work part-time sometimes at a wonderful bookstore here in Salt Lake called the King's English. And so I really do love a book as a book. And I do think it's probably a little bit generational, but I do see lots and lots of kids come in and they're buying books. I mean, I think the kids' world in publishing as of right now has been less affected by the whole electronic thing than perhaps adult fiction.
Hmm. Do you see a connection between, you know, we've been talking about the handwritten note and mm-hmm. having a book in your hand, having a newspaper in your hand, actual physical?
It feels like it, doesn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. it feels like there's something about the tactile experience as opposed to a more cyber-based type experience. And there's certainly a place for both, but what I would hate is for the cyber world to completely replace the experience in real time of certain kinds of things. And that's something that we're looking at on a lot of fronts, of course. But yeah, I mean, that whole thing of literacy somehow also being bound up in paper and pen and book and all of that, I think they're definitely related.
We've been talking with Ann Cannon, who is an author of young adult fiction, also a creative writing teacher, and as you no doubt know, Salt Lake Tribune columnist.
And I want to say something else. I'm also the mother of an Aggie. I've got a son up there at Utah State.
Wonderful.
I know.
Very, very good. We'll give you points for that.
Go Blue.
Ann Cannon, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Hey, thank you so much, Tom.
And join us tomorrow in the program. We'll be talking about the intersection of religion and politics with this Mormon moment and Mitt Romney being the front runner in the Republican race for president. We'll talk with Crystal Young Otterstrom of the new Democratic LDS caucus. And in the major part of the program, we'll be talking about this with Notre Dame professor David Campbell and with USU professor Philip Barlow. Your questions and comments are welcome. That's tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.